Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Cindy Alvarez. She is the author of Lean Customer Development, Building Products Your Customers Will Buy. Look at all those stars you've got on Amazon. This is doing really well. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's good to be here today.
This is cool. So when did the book come out? A couple years ago, right?
Yeah, book came out in July of 2014.
Mm-hmm. And it's over at O'Reilly, and I work on the OzCon conference, but which is also O'Reilly, but not related. It's just a coincidence that you're an O'Reilly author and I have a relationship with O'Reilly, just to put that out front. But I was recommended your book from John Montgomery, one of our shared bosses up the chain there. So I'm excited to chat with you about this.
Yeah. So let's kick it off.
This, John actually went and bought like a ton of these books and started passing it around. So he is your fan. The name Lean on the book cover is big because Lean is like a topic right now, like Lean software, Lean. I had Tom and Mary Poppendick come on and talk about Lean processes. How is this a buzzword? Is this being used as a buzzword, or is this mean something more than just a buzzword?
So, yes and no. The funny thing is actually, the reason the title is Lean Customer Development is because the O'Reilly series of books all started with Lean. Customer development is one of the tenets of Eric Ries's original Lean startup philosophy. There's no such thing as non-Lean customer development. I mean, I guess there could be, but it's not as though there was an existing thing that this is different from. But Lean in general is a sense of not wanting to waste, to wanting to learn as quickly as possible. And some of you may be familiar with, you know, from the Lean Startup book, the notion of learn, measure, build. And so the title, the subtitle of the book really kind of gets at that is, we don't want to be building things that no one wants. We don't want to build things that people aren't going to buy. We don't want to build things that we're going to get stuck supporting for years that don't really meet customers' needs. So in that sense, Lean is its own kind of thing. And I think the tenets that make it not buzzwordy are the notion that we have to go in being prepared to be wrong. And that means we have hypotheses and we work to disprove them. And our goal really is to disprove ourselves as often as possible, which is pretty uncomfortable.
So one of the things that you said there was a hypothesis, like having a hypothesis is important. Like without one, it can't be validated or invalidated.
Right. And I think a lot of people believe that they have a hypothesis because how could you build a product without one, right? That's kind of the starting point where I usually come in and talk to people and they say, well, of course we have a hypothesis. And I found it's really interesting to have people do a sticky note exercise where you say, okay, what is the measure of success for this product? Like this product will succeed if it does X, or what will our customers find most valuable about our product? And when you do that and you have people who've been working on a team together, even co-located for months, they will write down different things on that piece of paper. And so there's always these assumed hypotheses. And on a team of 10 people, you probably have 10 different hypotheses. And no one is actually actively trying to disprove them because why would we want to do that? That's super uncomfortable.
Wow. That seems like I believe you, but at the same time, I'm like, that's impossible. Like, how could we all not be in the same room or on the same team or in the same Slack and not be generally marching in the same direction or putting all the wood behind one arrow? You're saying that unless we actually assert those assumptions, we might all be heading in slightly different directions, generally the same direction, but slightly different.
Yeah. And there'll be slightly different directions. There'll be things like, For example, for any product, there's several different customer types. And one person might have a belief that this customer type is by far the most important, and this customer type is less important but still important, and these people are maybe a future market but not that important. And the person next to them will put those weightings just a little bit different. And even if you're just off by 5%, that might make the difference between choosing to invest in a feature that isn't really going to pay off for you and your team, because it's the least important customers who benefit from it. And it might even be actively bad for your best customers. And so kind of constantly questioning that and having people assert this is what we believe and this is why saves a ton of time later on.
You said a couple of words there, though, that were kind of like subjective adjectives, like what are our best customers? How do you measure something like that?
Sure. So we all want jobs, right? So our best customers are people who use our products and pay us for those products. that's basically it. So in the case of something like Yammer, which is where until recently I worked, that's part of Office 365. So we don't have a standalone sort of set of people purchasing this and not other things. So we look at usage. For people who are selling individual SKUs, it might be usage. It might be downloads. If you build apps for the App Store, it may be in-game purchases. Your best customers are the people who are buying 1,200 Pokecoins, you know, every week. They're not the people who have never spent money. Those people are useful in terms of spreading buzz, but after a certain point, buzz does not pay our salaries.
But it seems like if you look at what people do on, what Snapchat just sold for like $1 billion, right?
Right.
No one was paying them though. So they're going based on the power of a ton of people use us, which I don't know if that's power or not. That's just the step one, get a bunch of customers. Step two, profit.
Right. And that's a bet that doesn't pay off for very many companies. But when it does, it pays off tremendously. If you think of Facebook initially, no one was paying anyone for that. Now they make a ton of money on advertising, targeting, possibly swung an election recently. A lot of power came out of that. But, you know, I've been in the software industry long enough to have seen a lot of companies who did that, will build an audience and then monetize it later somehow. And most of them aren't still with us.
Okay. So that's a risky way to do things. Ultimately, people do have to pay and you have to optimize for those. So you want to make acquisition easy and then, but still optimize for those that are paying.
Sure. I would also say that in the case of Snapchat, they may be looking at the type of audience they have too. So the other thing is not just that in most cases you want people to be paying, but there's the saying that if you're not paying for something, you are the product. So if the consumers of a particular product are particularly valuable, that's more likely to pay off as well. And so in that case, you might be looking at the usage of, are these millennial teens that we expect to have a lot of buying power soon? In that case, they're a more attractive audience than maybe, you know, lower income, middle-aged folks who are unlikely to change their socioeconomic status. I don't know. That's getting more into pricing and economics than my normal forte, but.
Sure. But it does, it's good to put this in the context, maybe not of pricing, but rather products that we use. Like I know a ton of people that are excited about Slack and use it, but I don't know if I know anyone who, like, we all use it for free. Like, we use the free one, you know, I don't know a lot of people throwing money at Slack as an example. So getting this back to where it started, which was best customers.
Right.
How do you measure that? And then it also gets me thinking about the best aren't necessarily the loudest customers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I see a lot of people chasing loud customers.
Yes, because they're right there. It's so easy to hear from vocal customers. And sometimes they coincide with best. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they coincide with the people who are paying us a lot of money, but who may not actually be that devoted to our product. But what we want to look at is, are they the best in terms of, as our market grows, they're going to continue to be with us? And also, are they representative? So you know, especially in the startup world where I came from, a lot of times you'd get one blue chip customer who was the kind of person you'd be excited to put the logo, their company logo on your website. Like, yes, we've made it. We have, you know, whoever it is. We have Nintendo. We have Fidelity. We have America Online. I kind of dated myself there. but anyways, you have one of those customers who's paying you a lot of money that everyone has heard of. And it serves to legitimize your business, but their needs may be incredibly non-representative. And so you want to build things to make that customer happy, which ends up making your product much less good and usable and compelling for other audiences. And I've definitely been at startups where we chased that one customer who kept wanting things that were uniquely suited to their business that actually were detriments to other people adopting the product.
Exactly. I think that there are these charged words like best and right that can send one in the wrong direction, especially if you're a startup and you get like the one customer, you end up building the product for them. And like internally, you know, we do this thing called dog fooding at Microsoft where we'll go and like get a customer that dog foods or eats their own dog food. And then the next thing you know, are you building the .NET framework or are you building a really great runtime for Xbox to use?
Yes.
So what is best and what is right can make the, you can fool yourself into thinking that you validated your hypothesis, but you really just found a great customer who's excited about your product. But that's not the right thing for real people.
Again, right.
Now you're making me worried about all of my adjectives, like best and real and right. Like, well, what is best?
I'm having the same effect. And it makes me laugh because, you know, I have managed researchers for the past few years, and I always caution them about saying everyone or all. So because our sample sizes are small, you cannot say everyone is confused by this because we know that that can't possibly be true. And it just gives people an opening to like pick at the rest of your methodology. So it's many people. We keep talking to people who say this. The softener words actually are very useful. But I think, you know, that customer that's in front of us, you know, I kind of want to bring it back to hypothesis, right? If you look at the rest of science, you can't have a hypothesis and prove it in one limited context and declare it a success. That doesn't work for FDA trials. It doesn't work for, you know, creating a light bulb or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's where I keep pulling it back to that hypothesis. You know, you can never prove a hypothesis. You can elevate it to a theory, but there's always a chance that something will come along. And so when we put a product in front of one customer or even several customers that are very tightly united in terms of their behavior, we can't necessarily extrapolate that out to a big market. And so that's where we take that notion of trying to disprove it. So if we say, look, Xbox loves this framework. It's amazing. They're obviously a really impressive customer. We've got really smart people using it. Let's keep doing more of this. You know, the lean methodology says this is where someone should say, wait a second, we should disprove this. We should find other customers that are like Xbox to see if they still like our product. We should find customers who are equally attractive in terms of how much they could be using the product and paying us, but who are not Xbox. And we should see what they do. We should see how they behave. Because it's possible that if we took this framework that Xbox is using and put it in front of, you know, an NVIDIA or, you know, even a, you know, a hedge fund trader or someone like that,
right,
that they would say, this is crap. We're never going to use this. And, you know, a business cannot sustain on that one blue chip customer.
So then parsing that, this is good. This is very helpful to me. The parsing validate or invalidate, is it a matter, like you can invalidate a hypothesis from a scientific perspective. You can invalidate theories. And you can use those invalidations as weapons.
Yes.
To invalidate entire products and say, well, we're in completely the wrong direction. Does that work in a customer and product development fashion? Can you say, nope, we've just invalidated everything. Like it all stops now. Or does it just mean, well, that's not going to work for those customers?
Right. I have never seen it come to a full stop in an enterprise, and it probably never will.
Okay.
I have seen, for example, I do a lot of startup mentoring, and I've seen startups where they entirely pivoted because they don't yet have products or customers, and they went out and they talked to 20 people who represented what they thought was their best market and said, man, none of these people are going to pay us for this. You know, I just quit my day job. I can't pursue something that none of my target customers want.
Yeah.
Or better yet, people who say, I'm not going to quit my day job because I don't think I have anything here yet. So I've definitely seen entire things pivot or be scrapped based on this methodology. Where when you get into either a small existing company or, you know, certainly at a Microsoft-sized company, you might invalidate something. You might say, look, the majority of developers today are making these decisions. That doesn't mean you can stop developing something legacy that's been around for 10 or 20 years, because even that diminishing population is still paying you money and still having value. What it can do is change the percentages of where you're investing time. So back to those vocal customers, if they represent an edge case of your future business, okay, they're really loud, they're paying us a lot, but we think going forward, they're going to be a diminishing part of our market. In that case, you might say, we're going to invest 15% of our time in the things they want and put 85% on newer things, or, you know, fill in your own percentages. But it helps adjust those percentages to where your best opportunity cost is.
Mm-hmm. So how do you find a balance between interviews, which often get referred to as, like, I've heard them termed verbatims or anecdotes. Sometimes people use those as data and they imply, like, this is a fact. Well, like, no, that's an interview and that's a thing that someone said. How do you balance that with telemetry and then more generalized customer feedback, which isn't in a formal one-on-one interview?
Sure. So I treat interviews as a risk reduction tool initially. So what you're trying to do is make sure that we're not making any obviously wrong mistakes. And because we assume that we're not going to make obviously wrong mistakes, that sometimes that's tough for people to get their heads around. I say, well, you know, we're smart people. We're not going to make these obvious mistakes. And rather than try to argue that point, I usually just have people join me on a customer call and ask them to take notes. And then at the end of it, typically they say, whoa, we were really wrong about a lot of things. So interviews are a great way of making sure that you're not making big, obvious mistakes. Mm-hmm. It's also a really good way of looking at things that telemetry will never be able to answer for you, which is essentially why. Why did someone do that? You can make inferences based on data, but they're often wrong. Whereas if you watch someone do something, set a configuration, automate something, make a purchasing decision, and you kind of ask them questions around, how did you make that decision? Or how have you done this in the past? You realize that there's a lot of why things that weren't coming through. So you're never going to get that out of telemetry. And the other thing is that the interviews are often kind of these canaries in a coal mine. So a lot of times when I've done interviews, you know, for Yammer and past products, I would hear things from customers that were very surprising. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't just talk to five weird people in a row. And so that's generally when I would look to the data, either myself or to a data analyst, and kind of say, we've heard a lot of people complaining about this area of the product. Is there anything that in our usage patterns that suggests that this is a big pattern? You know, are people who use this part of the product less likely to come back? Are they less likely to post on Yammer? And a lot of times our data analysts were able to run some queries and say, you know, yeah, there's some there. For example, people who used Yammer and actually rated it highly, they said, we love this thing. We'd ask them, what was the last thing you posted? And they would say, oh, I don't post. I'm kind of reluctant to post. Some people actually use the word scared. And when I brought that back to the product team originally, you know, there was almost some derision, like, you know, scared to post. That's ridiculous. And I thought about this and I thought, well, how can we prove that this is true? Seeing as we can't look into people's content. And working with our analytics, we found that posting rates, the odds of whether a single person was likely to post or not, were incredibly higher in private groups and incredibly higher in small groups. And both of those combined with some of these verbatims, made a really strong case that, yeah, people don't want to look stupid. And they're afraid that posting is going to make them look stupid because they don't actually know who's going to read it or how it's going to be interpreted. And so that actually led to some changes in the product to help make it feel like a smaller, you know, more team-based kind of product.
I see. So someone would, it's like, I'm often afraid that I'm going to send something to more than a certain amount of people. So I like it when I like, if I put a bunch of distribution lists or groups on Outlook, Outlook has a little thing that pops up that says, you're about to send this to 4,000 people by adding up all right. the different people. Are you sure? You
right. And I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great preventing you from feeling stupid kind of tool.
But it also gets to that point though, of like you are, this is a talk to everyone in the company tool and people are afraid to use it because they don't want to talk to everyone in the company.
Yeah. And because people have seen words twisted, people have seen casual, oh, we could probably do that in 2 weeks being taken as gospel. And then, you know, when 2 weeks passes and the thing isn't done, someone gets yelled at because they made an offhand comment. And that's more of a critique of corporate culture than our product, but you know, the two are intertwined, of course. And that's actually really common. Corporate culture and where those products are used are often intertwined. And social culture and the context where people use consumer products are often intertwined. And those things don't make it into customer feedback and they don't make it into usability tests often as well, because people are trained to think that usability testing is about the product and how well I can use it. But if the problem is that this product is not what all the cool kids are using, you know, to go to the Snapchat example, then you're not going to hear an email saying, I didn't use this because my friends aren't using it. But you would, in a conversation, hear something like, I have to get an iPhone because all of my friends are on iMessage, and if I'm not there, I won't get invited to parties. That might be a really big factor in your product development process is, oh, people are making these decisions based on their friends or their spouse or what their manager thinks is a good use of their time.
Mm-hmm. When people do these interviews, I assume that there are behaviors that they could do that would invalidate the interviews or kind of mess up the interviews. Like just like interviewing people for a job is both an art and a science, and one could invalidate the interview. They can screw it up and make and leave a person unhappy. I assume that people could also do an interview with a customer and do the product a disservice if they exhibited certain behaviors during that interview. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think, you know, not to pick on engineers, but I feel like this is a thing that happens frequently, is if your sense of the world is to be a problem solver and to look to make things right, even with the best possible intentions, you might try to talk people out of their feelings or attempt to find a solution where someone was not looking for it. Or try and basically defend your product. You built it. And those are the only times when I've really seen interviews go badly, is you're talking to someone, they're opening up to you, they're saying, oh, look, I just find this really hard to use because I try and do this, and they get interrupted with, wait, 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 that's not how you're supposed to use it. Let me show you how it should be done. And that's really, oh, that makes us feel pretty awful. And, or someone might say, I really wish your product did this. And someone says, oh, but it does. Didn't you look under this menu? Those things get really bad. Or anytime someone talks about a feeling, asking why, which is a great question, but needs to be softened. Just recently, I was sharing some feedback about Teams, back with Microsoft Teams, back with the Yammer team. And I said that I did something that made me feel stupid. And one of my ex-coworkers said, well, why did you feel stupid? And I immediately felt more stupid. I didn't even really want to answer him. And so you can get in these negative feedback loops. So there's this kind of very much sense of trying to be very zen about taking it all in, not arguing with anything, gently asking more questions. You know, if that coworker had said, wow, that's really interesting. I'm just curious, Cindy. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you felt that way? I wouldn't have had that same immediate aversive reaction. And it can feel kind of fake sometimes, which is why I often suggest that people who are trying to implement customer interviewing start out as note takers and with someone like a user researcher doing the interview, because those are people who have been trained to take a very neutral tactic.
Yeah, this is something I think, like, one could argue that an engineer or myself or whoever, I'll just throw myself under the bus, you know, could, you know, use that as an opportunity to try to validate themselves, make themselves feel better, make them feel better about the product that they just built while they're hearing, you know, possibly negative feedback. If someone wasn't successful using their product, you know, that makes me, the interviewer, feel bad, but it's not about me. Like, this is an interview that is literally in no way about me. So you're asking for them to be empathetic. All you want is empathy.
Right. And I think a lot of times what's helpful is to have a little bit of a training before people jump into interviews, mm-hmm. where we basically reinforce that and say, you know what, you're going to hear some people complain about your product, which you are proud of. Mm-hmm. And the point is that you want it to be better than it is today. And by listening to these people and understanding their behaviors and how they make decisions and how they use our product, we can figure out how to make it better. So it's very much a local maxima problem. If we don't listen to customer interviews, we feel like we're at the top of that peak. But when we listen to them and we kind of see what the actual opportunities are, we realize, you know, this is a local maxima. It's going to get worse. We're going to have to go through the period of hearing how our baby is ugly, but then it's going to get much better. And I find that even just reminding people of that is a really helpful way of helping them go through an interview and not, you know, feel terrible.
For, if you don't mind, for people who may not speak English as a first language or may not be familiar with that term, could you just very briefly talk about what local maxima and local minima are in that context?
Sure. Ooh, let's see if I can actually explain it in a mathematical way, because I probably cannot. So there's a sense of, based on the information you know today, that's how you're evaluating your success. Mm-hmm. And a local maxima is where, as far as your information is telling you today, you're doing well. You're at the top of your game. And, you know, you can't see me do the little hand motion, but, you know, if you see it graphed, you'll see there's like a peak and then a valley and then a higher peak. And once you broaden your perspective, you bring in more information, you might notice that, hey, you're on top of a hill, but you're actually right next to a mountain. And so, but to get to the top of that mountain, you're first going to have to descend the hill and be even lower. And you're going to feel like you're losing ground, right? Because you were at a higher altitude and you came down and now you have a lot more climbing to do. But most of us would rather scale the big peak. That's, you know, that's why we do what we do. We build great things. And so we have to have that, you know, short-term blow and short-term a drawback.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's that point of the limit of the current design. But if you make a big change, you could potentially reach a much higher maxima and mathematically an extrema.
Yes.
All right. Cool. I appreciate that. So, in the book, you cover all of the stuff that we've talked about. You talked about validating and invalidating the hypothesis. You actually go through play by play how to do the customer interviews. So detailed, kind of like pragmatic advice on what people can do. It's only a couple years old, but I'm just curious, is there anything that you would add in the 3 years since the book came out, or any lessons that has invalidated any aspect of the book in your mind?
There is nothing that I would say has been invalidated, mm-hmm. but there's probably another chapter that could be added, which is essentially the why you tried this and it didn't work. And I've actually given that as a workshop a few times. And, you know, to summarize briefly, it's if you try this in a place that is not willing to accept the changes, it's not entirely worth the effort. So to practice lean in general means letting go of strict project plans and deadlines and scope, mm-hmm. which were always kind of a myth, but we held to them, right? We said, you know, we're going to build these things in this amount of time. We've got burn down charts. We've got estimates of how long each thing will take. If you are approaching a hypothesis with the intent to prove it wrong, you can't do that, because you might find out in week one that we were wrong about this. We shouldn't build this feature. So we should build this other thing instead, and that thing will take longer. Or the reverse. Occasionally you say we can cut scope, but, you know, obviously that happens less often. So if you're in an organization that's not willing to give up the security of those deadlines and that knowledge that we've got a marketing launch, we're going to announce these features in 3 months, you know, come hell or high water. If your org's not going to give any on that, then there's no sense doing this because you will get interviews and nothing will change. So I would say save your breath in that case. The other thing is that even in an org that's willing to accept that chaos, what I found happen with customer development, with lean in general, and I'm sure people have seen with agile as well, and pretty much any new approach that's been tried, is that if you're evangelizing something, you talk about the good and you talk about what we're going to get out of this. And you do a little bit of a silver bullet. Everything will be better once we do this, which is never true to start with. But it means that even inadvertently, people tend to sweep objections under the rug. So if I talk about doing interviews and someone on my team says, is this really going to work? The worst thing I could do is start talking about, of course, this is great. This is all everything we're going to learn. How could you even ask that? Because that's not going to convince that skeptic. It's just going to tell that person, okay, I'm not going to be honest around her anymore. I'm just going to quietly grumble and not really get with the program. And maybe that person will even undermine these efforts because, you know, they weren't really listened to. And so when teams start with this, I always say we should start with where everyone talks about why they think this won't work. Everyone get it out on the table. You know, it doesn't actually become a negativity session because the next thing you do is say, okay, great, Scott, you're telling me that this isn't going to work for this reason. How could we prevent that from happening? And a lot of times people are able to come up with that solution, but they haven't been given that kind of olive branch to say, you're right, there is a concern here, we should address it. And when you do that and prepare the team, we're going to do these interviews, what do you see as the risks? People will say, what if you talk to the wrong kind of customer? Okay, we're going to address that by being very clear about what customer segment we're talking to. And then if they're not promising, we'll switch to another customer segment. People say, we're going to do this and, you know, and the big boss is just going to come in and disagree at the last minute. Well, let's find out. What is the big boss's appetite for change? So listening to all of those objections and kind of preempting them, but not in a, you know, be quiet kind of way, but a tell me more and then let's fix it. Those are really critical. If you've laid that groundwork, then everything in the book works reasonably well. If you haven't, you're in for a lot of frustration. So I feel like if I do a second version or an addendum, it would be to add that chapter about getting yourself set up for success in those ways.
Very cool. Well, folks can visit you at CindyAlvarez.com. They can learn about your workshops. They can read all of your past blog posts and get a link right there to pick up the book, Lean Customer Development. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.